The next topic addressed was long-term adjuvant and post-adjuvant endocrine management of patients with ER-positive tumors, and Dr. Aman Buzdar presented a case with multiple key points of potential intervention.
This was a patient who came to see me in 1993, and at that point she had T2N1 disease, and she was ER-positive, PR-positive, and the HER2 we were not measuring. She received three cycles of actually pre-op chemotherapy with FEAC, which was fluorouracil, anthracycline, and cyclophosphamide, followed by three cycles of post-op chemotherapy with FAC. After that, since she was endocrine positive, we offered her endocrine therapy, but she elected not to take endocrine therapy. This was her choice. She didn't want to take any endocrine therapy.
What was her reason? You offered her tamoxifen, I imagine. What was the reason?
At that point, the standard was tamoxifen, and we discussed with her at length and told her that there is established efficacy and a lot of safety data to show that it will substantially reduce the risk of recurrence. But the reason for not taking was that she didn't want to take anything further modest gain, quote-unquote, on top of the chemotherapy which she already had.
So I guess the next step was 6 years later. What happened at that point?
This lady came to me, and also she was seeing at the same time a British physician every few months. And it was actually in the UK when they found her tumor marker was slightly elevated. And she came back to MD Anderson, and indeed her markers were going up. On evaluation, she was found to have hepatic metastases with minimal disease, actually, which was picked up. But her tumor marker, CA2729, was about 6 or 8-fold the normal. So there was no question that she had disease. At that point, we again talked about whether to start her with chemotherapy or with endocrine therapy. But after discussion, at this point now, the patient wanted to have something which could be offered and it will cause least morbidity in her case. So she was treated with tamoxifen, and surprisingly, she did extremely well. Her tumor marker came back to normal, and her imaging studies, including her MRI studies and the CT scans, returned back to normal.
Did she express any regret at not having taken adjuvant tamoxifen?
Actually, she wanted to talk about it, but my feeling is that I talk to the patient, I say, let's discuss what we can do now instead of looking back what we should have done then, because the thing is that you can't reverse anything, but you can do something prospectively. So even though she had some remorse, but I think to further indulge on that kind of thinking does not help the patient, but it causes a lot more guilt feeling. So I told her that what is done, let's go look forward and what we can do now from this point onward.
So she had a great response to tamoxifen for 3 years, then what happened?
She did extremely well, and she came to see me on a regular basis, and again her tumor marker started to go up and imaging studies started to show that she had now some active disease. Again, the imaging studies of the liver were starting to show that there is a disease which was showing evidence there. And at that point, I offered her, again, we had the same discussion, chemotherapy versus the endocrine therapy, and she elected to go with the endocrine therapy, and I started her on anastrozole. And she had an excellent response, and she did well until just very recently when she started to have progressive disease again in the liver. It's amazing that this lady shows the tumor markers and you see some slow but steady progression of the disease. At this point on progression of the disease, she was going to third-line therapy, so I again talked about various endocrine options, including fulvestrant, or talking about a steroidal aromatase inhibitor, or even we talked about progestins and things like that. And I thought that we go with fulvestrant, and we treated her with fulvestrant. She come back to see me about 12 weeks later, and her disease is kind of stable on imaging studies, and tumor marker shows just a small drop on the markers. So she is essentially showing some clinical benefit.
So this woman really kind of fits into the effect trial thing where you could choose between, as you mentioned, exemestane and fulvestrant. What caused you to recommend fulvestrant?
I think that at that point, because as you can see that this was several months ago, this was in the beginning of this year. At that time, we were doing the trial, and the trial was discussed, but the lady did not want to participate because she was living outside the U.S., even though she comes to see me on a regular basis. But the reason I discuss with the patient is that one, therapy requires intervention on a regular basis every day. Patient has to take a pill on a regular basis. Whereas the other thing is that you inject the patient and then the patient doesn't have to worry about thinking about her disease or getting any intervention until she come back to see you. So she wanted to do something which she didn't have to be reminded every day, and she elected to go with the fulvestrant.
So I'll ask Aman to review the clinical research database relating to these questions.
Fulvestrant has been looked at in previously heavily treated patient population, and it had a modest antitumor activity, clinical benefit rate in about a third of the patient. And a similar way, steroidal aromatase inhibitor exemestane has been looked at, which had about 20% antitumor activity. And the study which was carried out, EFFECT trial, is important trial to answer this question. Is there one drug which is better than the other in patients who have been previously treated with non-steroidal aromatase inhibitors? And this was a very well done study. It was a double-blind, placebo-controlled trial. So neither patient nor the doctors knew what drug the patient is receiving. And the time to progression and survival and the safety were the main endpoints. The other thing in this study was done was that patients were given a loading dose, because when we did the initial pivotal studies in which we did the PKs, actually it took about 2 to 3 months before you got to the steady state level. So in this study, patients were given loading dose initially so that the patients can get a very quick steady state level, so that there will be no window of opportunity where the patient does not have a steady state level and we can say that patient may be progressed because there was not enough drug in the blood. And the study data which was shown yesterday, the primary endpoint was time to progression, and the data clearly showed. Now we have a very clean, prospectively randomized trial in the third line setting, which showed that both drugs have similar antitumor activity. And we have now two choices which we can discuss with the patient, and we can tell the patient with reasonable certainty that you have two choices. You can take an injection or you can take a pill. Similar likelihood of benefit with the drugs. And if you look at the clinical benefit rate, they are very similar. 32% of the patients versus 31% of the patients got clinical benefit. The duration of response may be slightly longer for the fulvestrant patient compared to the patient with exemestane. Side effect profile of these two drugs are very similar. And when you look at all the side effects, they look very similar. And the PK data, patients achieved a steady state level very quickly after getting the loading dose compared to the patients who were getting a conventional FDA package insert every 4 weeks. I would also stress that if we're going to use the fulvestrant in that type of setting, we need to use it as it was studied in this protocol. Where are we going with this kind of drug? One of the study which is ongoing in the SWOG, where the efficacy of anastrozole, the anastrozole with fulvestrant in metastatic setting is being evaluated, and this trial is still accruing the patient. And there is a European study in which the efficacy of the fulvestrant with anastrozole is being looked at versus the placebo, and the third arm is the exemestane. I think these are two trials which are ongoing, and the efficacy and the safety of these trials will provide additional information to help us guide what is the best way to use these endocrine therapy in patients with metastatic disease.
Thanks, Aman. I want to pick up on both aspects of this case, therapy of metastatic disease and also delayed endocrine therapy. Mike, how would you answer the question? Assuming you can get it paid for, would you use a loading dose of fulvestrant?
Yes, the problem I think with fulvestrant is being getting the drug in at the right dose, and there's no doubt that a study we did in premenopausal women showed that although 250 milligrams did not have an effect, an anti-tumoral effect in premenopausal women, if we increased the dose to 750, we got an effect. So I think the big problem is 250 just doesn't get the dose high enough, quick enough.
This idea of combining an AI and fulvestrant, Mike, is fascinating. Theoretically, it's kind of like the flip side of increasing the dose, it seems. Do you think that that's a rational strategy to use in a non-protocol setting? Of course, it's being looked at in these studies. Is it something you might consider outside of a protocol, Mike?
Might do. I mean, it's kind of interesting because we were talking about 7 or 8 years ago, and as things come around slowly sometimes, but it certainly makes a lot of biological sense. And if things make biological sense, usually they work, so your kind of gut feeling is it would be a sensible thing to do.
Dabu, from a clinical perspective, how do you sort out the decision between fulvestrant and an oral endocrine agent such as an aromatase inhibitor in your patients?
Probably as initial therapy, and as we saw for second-line therapy, these agents are probably equivalent in efficacy. So obviously it makes sense to discuss it with the patient and see if their preference is. Sometimes we expect that our patients will always prefer oral therapy. That's not the case. Sometimes there's compliance issues that may make an IM formulation better. So I really think that these drugs are interchangeable and can be used in different line settings. Certainly after a non-steroidal, we know that exemestane by formal proof now is similar to fulvestrant. So it really is an individualized choice based on the patient's preference and compliance.
Let's talk a little bit about the long-term course of breast cancer, particularly ER-positive disease. Cliff, how do you advise your patients who are out 5 to 10 years, for example, and how do you assess what their residual risk of recurrence is at that point? What factors do you look at to try to make a guess of what their recurrence rate might be over, say, between year 5 and 10?
Well, the first thing is that their yearly risk is actually very little different after the 5th year. So the same factors that would have driven my decision at the beginning are still operative. What I mean is if they were high risk at the beginning, they're still relatively high risk on a yearly basis after the 5th year. And in fact, if there was adequate risk to justify therapy for the 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th year, I don't personally see a big difference in talking about the 7th and 8th and 9th year based on the data that we have right now.
And how, of course, their trials, particularly the NSABP, is now looking at the issue of going beyond 5 years in an aromatase inhibitor. What do you do in your practice, though, when you see patients are coming up to the 5-year point, they're not eligible for the NSABP trial?
Well, you know, I think the extended adjuvant trials and the overview with ever-increasing follow-up have really sensitized us to the fact that this is a disease with a very long natural history. For the moment, I usually limit the AI treatment to about 5 years. That's where we have safety and efficacy data, and I hope that we'll have more data from, for instance, the MA17 extension trial before too long. But for the moment, I think if you've completed 5 years of an AI, there's not a lot of data that you should continue. As we're using more and more AIs up front, this issue is going to start to arise in the next couple of years as lots of women finish 5 years of AI treatment. And I think it's a good time to assemble some trials to really ask that question, as the NSABP has done.
John, multiply node positive patient who hits 5 years is doing great, tolerating the AI well. Are you going to stop it?
Well, I think there is no data to suggest what we should do formally one way or another. But I think that in the situation with the known risk and the clear safety of aromatase inhibitors over a long term, as long as you're watching their bone health, recommending vitamin D, calcium, exercise, and monitoring of DXA, I would think I would continue it for such a high-risk woman, yes.
I'll ask Chuck that same question. Are there patients where you'll offer continuation beyond 5 years of an AI?
Yes, I do, for the same reasons that John just iterated, really. I mean, the drugs seem to be reasonably safe. The patient is tolerating it. They're not having excessive joint pain. They're doing the things that they need to do to protect their bones. I tend to continue the high-risk patient.